You know, here on No Nonsense Nutrition, I always get plenty of material for shows. I get plenty of material for shows from the clients that come to visit me in the clinic. And I read a story a couple of weeks ago, and I'm sorry I can't credit the author, but they talked about the fact that even people who had committed to eat healthy often went into fast food joints and ordered the worst of the worst. And, you know, they were trying to make some sort of psychology out of it and saying, well, people were treating themselves. They felt like they had, quote, been good all week, and so they deserved a treat. And you know what? I think there's a real flaw in that reasoning, or lack of it, because one of the things that I see every single solitary day in my clinical practice are individuals who definitely want to be healthier, but sometimes don't do the planning that is necessary in order to be healthier. I've often said, if you plan, your planning is really all about your success. You know, we could turn it into a bumper sticker and say, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. But what's true is there's a whole lot of people that are just so freaking busy. Too busy to make food number one on their list. And, you know, I hear these stories from individuals. It was interesting when I made my trip to South Africa recently, one of the clinicians that was at the program there came up and told me her story and asked for suggestions of things she could do. And the very first suggestion I made to her was that she take a whole chicken and put it in a pot and boil it for an hour. And she's shaking her head while I'm saying it. And I went, what's the problem? And she says, I don't have time to do that. And I went, you put a chicken in a pot of water and you turn the fire on. I mean, you know, this is not rocket science here. And she says, I just don't have time to do something like that. And so here she is complaining about a health problem, and she is a clinician, and yet she wasn't willing to make herself a chicken stew. And what I was going to design, I'd tell you the rest of the recipe after she boils the chicken for an hour, take the chicken out, put it on the counter, let it cool down enough that you can handle it so that you can skin it and bone it and get the grizzle out. And in the meantime, keep that chicken broth boiling so that it starts to reduce and concentrate itself, and throw in a cup of brown rice and 3-4 carrots and 3-4 stalks of celery and a great big onion and 5 or 6 cloves of garlic and maybe a big zucchini and a handful of green beans and mushrooms if you like them, and then just keep it simmering away for an hour, and then add the chicken pieces back in, and you can divide that up and eat off of it for a couple of days. So, no, it's not my usual recommendation. I usually recommend that we have a lot of variety in our diet, and that what we ate yesterday is not the same thing as we eat tomorrow. Just because every time you eat variety, you're getting a different nutritional fingerprint than you got the day before. But in her instance, when she was talking about how incredibly busy she was, I figured that this chicken stew was something that she could eat off of for 4 or 5 days and, you know, do really well. And so her repetitive declarations of the fact she didn't have time, she didn't have time, she didn't have time, I finally turned to her and said, well, I guess you'll have to make time to be sick. And it wasn't trying to be a smart mouth in that particular instance. It was just saying, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail. So when I look around at the fast food restaurants, I also came upon another factoid that said 50% of all American dollars that are spent on food are for meals eaten outside the home. So if you spend $100 a week on food, you're spending 50 bucks a week on food in restaurants and 50 bucks a week in food in your house. That's essentially the formula. And the fast food industry is really heeding these demands, and it's begun to offer a little bit of healthier food out there in the fast food lane. But, you know, one of the biggest problems has been in the fast food lane is that a lot of the, quote, healthy choices were tasteless and yucky and, you know, just not very good. And I'm happy to say that that's starting to change. Taco Bell did one of the first outreaches, because just by offering a bean burrito in a soft shell, they managed to actually give us some food that was golly really healthy. So as I see the landscape of American food change, and with all of the traveling I do get an opportunity to see more places, or at least hear about places that are not just quick serve restaurants, but this category that we now call fast casual, things like Chipotle's, or the premium fast casual, which is where you actually sit down and get the food delivered to you. But when we look at all of the junk food sector, and we're trying to make a step up, we're trying to move out of the McDonald's and the Subways and their ilk and moving up to the Starbucks and the Five Guys and those places that sort of give an aura of being healthier, but in fact are, you know, just groovier settings that have a few organic ingredients or a few sustainable ingredients. And move up to that notch where we have this category that is referred to as fast casual, where we're actually getting real food. You know, Chipotle, the food is fresher in the fact that they actually prepare their guacamole right on the premises. The chicken, you know, no matter how tasteless it might be, is cooked right in front of your eyes. And it's pretty easy to eat vegan there. So when we look at the choices that are out there, we just want to be aware of the fact that if you're going to spend 50% of your food dollar outside your house on restaurant meals, you need to be afraid. You need to be very afraid. And the reason that I say that is that we have seen all too many instances of food poisoning actually increase simply because of antibiotic resistance. You know, the Director General of the World Health Organization was really blunt when he said that the world is facing an end to modern medicine as we know it. When we look at the fact that we're entering a period of time where strep throats can kill people, that hip replacements could become too dangerous to undertake, it's because we're losing our antimicrobial drugs to antibiotic resistance. You've heard me talk about this before on No Nonsense Nutrition. You know, to quote the current Director General of the World Health Organization, the pipeline is virtually dry, the cupboard is nearly bare. You know, back in the beginning of the 1980s, when HIV showed up on the scene, we began to shift research from bacteriology into virology. Prior to the middle 1980s, bacteriology was one of the biggest science departments of research that existed in the United States. We came up with antibiotic after antibiotic after antibiotic. And then when HIV showed up on the scene and when Hep C started to become a real issue, the money shifted over into virology research. And so today, when you go on a lot of medical research campuses, you will find seven-story buildings of virology research, and the bacteriology department has ended up in the basement of the library. And so when we realize that the use of antibiotics to be given to meat, to be given to poultry, to even be used with fishes, that antibiotic may kill a whole lot of the bad guys. It kills some of the good guys too, but it can create resistance. You've heard me say many times on No Nonsense Nutrition that we kill the weakest and we leave the strongest behind. And that strongest antibiotic-resistant bacteria in this instance is what causes the outbreaks that even the Food and Drug Administration calls critically important, highly important. We had 55 very big food poisoning outbreaks in the United States over the last 30 years. from dairy products, ground beef, poultry, produce, seafood, pork, eggs. But what happened the most commonly was salmonella. The nature of the salmonella is that we have created an antibiotic-resistant salmonella. And in 2011, there was a healthy 31-year-old woman who shared a dinner of beef tacos with friends in her home up in Maine. And suddenly, out of nowhere, she started feeling like she had the flu. And she kept getting worse. And when her persistent bloody diarrhea wouldn't stop, she went to the emergency room. They gave her IV fluids. She had intense pain. She had alternating pangs of hunger and thirst. She was treated with morphine every couple of hours until the doctors tried to figure out what was going on. She actually began to wonder whether life was worth fighting for. And it was not until the hospital staff did the stool cultures that they found the salmonella that is one of the leading causes of food poisoning in the United States. She was one of 20 known victims infected with a new strain of Typhimurium, Salmonella Typhimurium, and it is resistant to at least 8 antibiotics, including things like tetracycline. And so they finally traced back the contaminated ground beef that was sold by a supermarket chain. But even the Center for Disease Control couldn't identify the meat supplier because the grocery chain hadn't kept good records. But happily, this bug was still susceptible to one of the antibiotics called Cipro, and it helped to cure her infection. I've said many times here on the show that if there's one thing that you would never get me to eat in a public place, it's ground meat. And this is one of the reasons why. When we look at that 7-state outbreak that sickened this young woman, we have to realize that those outbreaks, well, maybe in total, you could say they didn't affect all that many people. But the antibiotic resistance is spreading, and one of the places that it's spreading is through fast food joints. When the reason that I can make that statement is not just the one of the infections that got the most press, HO157, that happened at a Taco Bell, but simply because of the fact that the quality of foods, the bottom end quality of foods that are often used at fast food restaurants are much more likely to be contaminated. The National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System, I guess you didn't know about that, which consists of both the FDA and the Center for Disease Control and about a dozen state public health laboratories, it buys chicken and ground turkey and ground beef and pork chops and at stores every year to test for antibiotic-resistant bacteria, and it has no trouble finding them. In 2011, which is the latest year that's available, this National Antimicrobial Resistance Monitoring System found salmonella in 12% of all the chicken samples that it tested. 3/4 of the bugs were resistant to at least one antibiotic, and more than a quarter were resistant to at least 5 classes of antibiotics. That's 8 times the level of multiple resistance that we found in 2002. Salmonella turned up in 12% of the ground turkey samples. 3/4 of the bacteria were resistant to at least one antibiotic, and almost 20% were resistant to at least 5 classes of antibiotics. E. coli was detected in 2/3 of the beef and 40% of the pork. Half of the E. coli on the pork and 1/5 of the E. coli on the beef were resistant to one antibiotic. And at least 1% of the E. coli was resistant to 5 different classes of antibiotics. That's triple the percentage that was found in 2002. So drug-resistant pathogens have contaminated meat and other animal foods and infected people with drug-resistant infections. We don't have any idea what the full extent of this is because so many of these cases aren't reported, or the problem, unfortunately, results in very severe illness and it is never tracked back to the original food poisoning incident. So my purpose isn't just to scare you about the fact that there are critters in the food. My purpose isn't just to make you aware of the fact that you need to be aware of the fact. It's also to tell you that there are other sources that we can receive toxins from. You know, we talk about salmon being such a healthy food. And yet we found that farmed salmon contains 7 to 10 times higher level of PCBs, dioxins, and pesticides than wild salmon. Farmed salmon absorb these PCBs, residues from electrical wiring, and other industrial chemicals from the fish meal that they're fed. It didn't matter whether the salmon was farmed in Canada or Chile or Norway or Scotland. It had way more PCBs, dioxins, and pesticides than wild salmon in every instance. So, you know, Environmental Protection Agency guidelines say don't eat farmed salmon more often than once a month. I had a client that came into my office last week and she eats salmon every other day, 15 times a month. Are the fish cleaner? Not according to the research. Until more studies are done, err on the side of caution. Don't eat farmed salmon more than once a month. Wild salmon, Alaska salmon, Pacific salmon, I'm happy. But Atlantic salmon, farmed salmon, not so happy. So is this be afraid, be really afraid? Well, there are some things that are done to our food that we don't even know about. You know, I attend a lot of conferences. And it was interesting when I was at a conference recently and they offered the choice of a vegetarian plate, a farmed salmon, or a piece of beef. And it was, you know, supposedly a piece of sirloin. And it's interesting that you could have hundreds of people in the room and they were fed a piece of beef that looked exactly like the one on the next plate and the next plate and the next plate. Well, a lot of people don't know that there is something called meat glue that's used. It's extracted from cow blood, and it seamlessly combined one piece of little bit of meat to another to make small pieces look like a steak. The enzymes have been used for years to minimize waste. It's a combination of, it's called transglutaminase, and it's produced by bacteria and the fibrin that floats around in our bloodstreams and the cow's bloodstreams as well. So we want to have uniform portions. You know, when a hotel orders 500 pieces of steak to feed a conference, everybody's is supposed to look the same. The enzymes are harmless. What's dicey is the fate of the disease-causing bacteria that might be on the outside of the meat that ends up glued on the inside of the meat. Bacteria that's on the surface of the steaks and roast are killed when the meat is grilled. But using meat glue can move the surface inside where it might not be cooked thoroughly enough to kill the bacteria. They say that there's been no food poisoning outbreaks that have been blamed on undercooked glued meat. But victims don't know what they're eating if it was fabricated with enzymes. So if you're eating a piece of steak at a wedding or at a conference or at some other function, please order it medium or well done. Please don't order it rare. I know it does sound like a science fiction show, doesn't it? That there's all kinds of things out there that can make you sick. Well, the thing I want you to do is to fix more of your own food. The whole reason that I want you to fix more of your own food is because you have control and you can use whole foods. The biggest message that I put out here at No Nonsense Nutrition is to eat food that occurs in nature. You know, I get into throwdowns on a pretty regular basis with the vegan and vegetarian clients that come into my clinic, not because I don't think that you can be healthy as a vegetarian. I absolutely do. I have some real questions about how healthy you can be as a vegan, because I'm still waiting to meet the healthy vegans that are out there. But, you know, there's some vegan chains of restaurants that are getting started, especially out in California, where it's so many of these trends begin, that are being offered to individuals that aren't necessarily vegans. You know, 70% of the people that stand in the line at these vegan fast food places are meat eaters. But it doesn't mean that they don't have a vegan meal now and then. So whether you go to the Native Foods Cafe or the Veggie Grill out in Los Angeles, these are vegan chains where you can get, you know, a pretty good sub and a pretty good salad and a pretty good meal. You can't get it for much under $20, so I wouldn't exactly call it fast food. But when you look at the Life Kitchen, Life is L-Y-F-E, it's love your food every day. It really is trying to build a chain of vegan choices in places like Native Food Cafe and the Veggie Grill. And Love Your Food Every Day, or the Life Kitchen, they're trying to offer healthy stuff. You know, grass-fed beef, humanely raised cows, dairy-free cookies. So there are changes that are out there, but you're going to take the best control when you're eating whole food. The throwdown that I get into is the number of people that are using, you know, soy knockoffs for protein or seitan knockoffs for, you know, meatballs. Seitan is a form of wheat gluten. And so you can see the conflict there with as many gluten-free clients that I see in my practice. And at the same time, using seitan as a meat substitute. But when people make something that looks like a McNugget and they're making it out of soy protein that is a long way away from a soybean, they actually use the same kind of technology that they use to make nylon stockings to make textured vegetable protein. You know, it's a step in the right direction because we save animals, we save water, we save energy, we save land. It's certainly, in terms of animal welfare and environmental damage and resource use, a step up. Just like the cheese that's made out of tapioca. It tastes a lot like pasteurized American processed cheese. But I'm not certain that all of these wannabe meats and wannabe proteins that are made from, you know, the soybeans and mushroom fungus like corn and these seitan products are really actually golly really eating whole food. The place that I think that we're going to get the greatest representation of the nutrients that our bodies evolved on. You know, over and over I hear arguments from people of what our ancestors ate. You know, the number of individuals that come into me with questions about the paleo diet and the caveman diet and the all-protein diet are profound compared to what they were even a couple of years ago. And then the next client that I have come in will come in and say, well, I'm eating breakfast biscuits. And I perk up my ears and say, breakfast biscuits? And sure enough, Nabisco has come out with breakfast biscuits. With energy-releasing B vitamins, specially baked to release energy regularly and fuel your body throughout the morning. Wow, that sounded really good. But they're saying it's a whole new kind of breakfast, but it's actually a cookie. A 230-calorie pack of four biscuits that has 3 grams of protein isn't exactly my example of what a breakfast should be. And then when I flipped the page on this client's food diary, and on the next day I saw honey bunches of, well, nonsense. because it said on the package that these honey bunches of oats were made with real Greek yogurt. But in fact, a pinch of yogurt powder was thrown in to the wheat and oats and sugar and rice and cornmeal and oil. But the powder is heat treated, so if there was any active culture in the yogurt, it's already gone. Boy, are we suckers for this stuff. So instead of calling it honey bunches of oats, we might have called it honey bunches of nonsense. Then I had a client that came in who was drinking a protein shake from Bolthouse Farms. And this is a company that's owned by Campbell Soup. And Campbell Soup has an illusion in our mind of being, you know, healthy and looking out for us. But I have to remember that during my trip to Australia, the Campbell Soup Company was being sued by the Australian government because the ad that they had on television, which is soup is good food, that the Australian government said that they could not put that ad on because it had their soup had over 1,000 milligrams of sodium in a serving, and you couldn't call that good food. So when my client said, oh, this is a great protein drink, I went to the store and read the label. And it said 64 grams of protein on the bottle, but it forgot to tell you that that's for the entire 32-ounce bottle. Somehow she expected there was 64 grams of protein in one 8-ounce serving. No. It went on to tell you that there was all of these impressive nutrients that are in there, and that it had 8 servings of fruits and vegetables per bottle. But actually, it was apple juice with a little bit of carrot juice and orange juice, and finally, mango puree, even though it was called a mango shake. So when you're eating non-whole foods, when you're trying to make a meal out of pieces and parts like breakfast cookies, protein plus shakes, and honey bunches of nonsense, you're not really eating food. And so you're going to jump in your car right now and you're going to go out and you're going to get a fast food breakfast. You just don't have time to even have a cup of fruit and a container of Greek yogurt, or you don't have 1 minute to put an egg in the microwave and make an egg sandwich, or do one of my clients' favorites, the things that I call egg muffins, where you scramble up an egg and put it in a muffin cup and put in there whatever flavorings or offerings that you'd have with an omelet. Maybe it's a spoon of salsa. Maybe it's a little cheese. Maybe you saute some onions or peppers or mushrooms or all of the above. And put a half a dozen of these egg muffins, no muck in this, egg muffins in a 325-degree oven for about 8 to 12 minutes, depending on the size of your muffin tin. And you've got something that you can just pick up and eat. My clients that commute in their car and were eating peanut butter and jelly sandwiches for breakfast, I turned them on to egg muffins and they love them. So you can go out and, you know, pick up one of these breakfast meals that, in fact, is pretty scary in terms of ingredients, pretty scary in terms of the amount of fat, the amount of sodium that's in there. Or you can look at some of the best of the fast food meals. You know, there's grilled sandwiches at a whole lot of places. You know, the trick is ordering it without the creamy sauce. But one of the healthier grilled chicken sandwiches out there is, you know, made at Chick-fil-A. But the grilled chicken at Wendy's and McDonald's, they're close seconds. You can even get a calorie-friendly honey mustard sauce at Wendy's. You can get a potato topped with chili over there. You can even go to KFC and get a grilled chicken breast and some corn on the cob. I would leave off the mashed potatoes only because that's 2 starches at once, and that's a ticket to diabetes. There is a chicken teriyaki bowl that they have at Jack in the Box. There is a char-grilled chicken wrap at Chick-fil-A. So the thing that we want to understand is whether we're getting a veggie burger and a garden salad at Burger King or a veggie delight sandwich and a bowl of tomato soup at the Subway, there are actually healthy foods out there that we can get. But we can actually go in the other direction. We can get some of the worst foods that are out there. I was astounded when I found out that Arby's farmhouse chicken salad had 12 grams of saturated fat in it, that the Burger King BLT with avocado ranch dressing had the same thing. When I look at some of these offerings of salads, whether they're coming from Taco Bell or McDonald's or KFC or Jack in the Box or even Chick-fil-A, they were dishes that were 1,200 milligrams of sodium. That's a half a teaspoon of salt. But there's the best salads out there, too. You know, when we realize that we can choose char-grilled chicken and put it on a garden salad over at Chick-fil-A, or we can get it at Jack in the Box or KFC or even at McDonald's, their premium Southwest salad with grilled chicken. Taco Bell has a Fiesta taco salad made with chicken or steak. There are things that are out there healthy, but you got to read some nutritional information. So the nutritional information comes down to doing some research. And that isn't usually what happens when we go to meet the family for a birthday bash. So I had a client in my clinic about 3 weeks ago. And she came in and said, oh, we always go to the Cheesecake Factory over in Tampa. We love going over there because they have just these amazing meals. And we don't eat them very often, so it's not a worry. So I asked her what her favorite was. And she said, oh, the shrimp pasta. That's the best. And I went, well, that's interesting. You're talking about shrimp pasta. I just read something about that in my Center for Science and the Public Interest newsletter. You know, I'm a big fan of about four different newsletters I get now. I used to get as many as a dozen of them, and I gradually wheedled them down because some of it was redundant and some of it was biased. But the Center for Science and the Public Interest has put out a great newsletter for years. And when I went back and looked up this shrimp pasta dish that she talked about, spoke of it in glowing colors, crispy battered shrimp, fresh mushrooms, tomato and arugula tossed with spaghetti and a basil garlic lemon cream sauce. I mean, how could you go wrong? Now, where is the first clue? Crispy battered. There's your first clue. But, you know, when you hear mushrooms and tomato and arugula, doesn't that sound delicious? Cream? For heaven's sakes, this sounds fabulous. Well, Cheesecake Factory has really created a knack for these over-the-top dishes. It's shown up more than a half a dozen times in the newsletter for extreme eating. But now it has won an award. It has won an award for the single meal that has the most calories of any meal anywhere in the United States. According to the company headquarters, the Bistro Shrimp Pasta has 3,120 calories. 3,120 calories. So that's about a day and a half worth of calories in a single plate. There's 89 grams of saturated fat. So that's enough to keep your arteries busy from Monday morning until Friday noon. And it's got 1,100 milligrams of sodium on top of it. Now, that's what happens when you mix 3.5 cups of pasta with buttercream sauce and then top it with batter-fried shrimp. It's like eating three orders of the Olive Garden's lasagna with an order of tiramisu for dessert. One meal. And that's before you have dessert. Because by the time that you add the chocolate cake for dessert that has 1,820 calories in it and 62 grams of saturated fat, you can be over 150 grams of saturated fat and 5,000 calories in a single meal. I guess they'll have to get a wheelbarrow to roll you out of there. But it sure looked good on the menu. So, no, you don't go to the web page of each of the restaurants that you visit and turn on to the nutrition list in order for you to have your menu. You go to the restaurant with a celebratory attitude to, you know, hang out with your family and friends and have something that's, you know, deeply yummy. But maybe we ought to wake up and smell the calories, wake up and smell the sat fats, wake up and realize that we've got to be pretty smart to eat food out in restaurants and stay in the healthy category. No, I don't think we have to be purists. I don't think it's a situation where you have to miss the ice cream or miss the cake. I don't think it's a situation that you can't have, quote, treats. But what is it that you're treating? You know, eat 12 dishes that contain 5,000 calories and 150 grams of saturated fat. By the time you eat 12 of them, you get a free crash cart. So when we begin to look at all of the little teeny tiny decisions that we make, we have to ask how much of what we're eating is food. Is it real food? Would your grandmother recognize it? Are you meeting the foundational standards that we know that have been demonstrated repeatedly in studies to not just increase longevity, but to decrease the signs of aging? Maybe there's no way that we can affect longevity at all. Maybe you're programmed in your genes. I don't know. There's no way that you could ever prove it. But the real issue is, how much time do you spend in the disability zone prior to death? You know, around here on the west coast of Florida, and especially here in Sarasota County, where fully 32% of all of the residents of Sarasota County are over 65 years old, and that number is headed up. We're going to have more than a third of all of the residents of Sarasota County over 65 by the end of next year. We can see individuals whose health span has ended long before their lifespan. They're living with various kinds of chronic disability for decades. So my objective as a clinician is not necessarily to extend your life. It's to make sure that you live every day of it, to reduce your disability zone. You've heard me say before that in Taiwan, the average term of disability prior to death is 3 weeks. Not only is the disability zone very narrow, but women live 10 years longer in Taiwan than they live in the United States. Men live 8 years longer in Taiwan than they live in the United States. And so, no, I don't want you to eat like a Taiwanese or live like a Taiwanese, but I think if you want a good role model, we ought to be looking at what they're doing, because the average term of disability in the United States is about 11 years. 3 weeks, 11 years. This isn't hard. Plus, women, if you live 10 years longer and you take out 10 plus years of disability, we're talking 20 years. This isn't chump change. This is a huge, big difference. Well, when we look at the Taiwanese diet, what do we see? We see a very significant amount of vegetables, 6 to 8 cups of vegetables every day. We see small amounts of animal food, almost a condiment, the size of a deck of cards, is often what's in the meal. So whether it's fish or shrimp or octopus, whether it's chicken, the idea is that it's a small amount, that it's there as the accessory to the meal instead of the foundation of the meal. So we, all the time you hear me flag, you can't eat too many vegetables. And you start with it at breakfast. when you saute those onions and mushrooms and peppers and tomato and the leftover broccoli or asparagus or the spinach that's in the freezer and you have your egg with it in the morning, you're adding that half to one cup of vegetables right at the beginning of the day. Even if you do that 3 days a week, do you see how much that adds up to at the end of the year? That's more than a laundry basket full of vegetables. When you stuff that sandwich with lettuce and tomato and sprouts and onions and cucumbers and you have a coleslaw on the side or a carrot salad on the side or celery sticks and carrot sticks and radishes as opposed to having a handful of chips, that adds up at the end of the year. There's another laundry basket or two full of vegetables. Having that side of soup with your sandwich in the wintertime is a lot heartier than having that handful of chips on the side with your sandwich in the wintertime. I made a salad this weekend for our WSLR 4th of July party. Thanks, Nancy and Steve, for hosting us. It was a lovely event. It's a great group of people to hang with, and taking food to that group, it's always appreciated. So when I made my Sedona salad with carrots and onions and celery and raisins and cheese and gluten-free bread and almonds, yum! I got to have the leftovers last night for dinner. You can't get too many vegetables into you. So even if you're going to run out to one of the fast food joints and you're going to get a grilled chicken sandwich, you can always bring your own goodies to go along with it. Because every opportunity that you have to increase the nutrient density of your food gives you an opportunity to have healthier cells. You know, we're as old as our cells. And our cells will do everything for us. Our cells let you listen to the show. Our cells let me drive here to the station. Our cells are what we hold allegiance for. Because my cells let me do everything I want to do. And all my cells ask for is good nutrition. The membrane of the cell asks for good quality fats. And so when I have that piece of Alaska salmon, when I have that guacamole on top of the salad, when I had that handful of almonds and cashews yesterday afternoon, I'm giving my body the good fats, the fats that are necessary in order to make the membrane of the cell work well. When I have fruits and I have those powerful antioxidants that come from the colors of the fruits, the bright red watermelon, the strawberry, the tomato, the orange papaya and cantaloupe and apricots and butternut squash and sweet potatoes, the yellow corn, the green and so many vegetables that come to us from the plant kingdom, the blue and purple colors from the blackberries and the blueberries, even the white and brown of the mushroom and the grains, the potato. Every single one of those colors gives us a different set of nutrients, a different set of antioxidants, a different set of polyphenols that slow down the aging rate of the cell. Even something as simple as the astaxanthin, the antioxidant that's present in the salmon, what makes the salmon pink and the shrimp pink and the lobster pink when we cook it, what makes the flamingos pink when they eat krill, goes into the cell membrane to keep the fats in the membrane from oxidizing and turning rancid. So you can't eat too much color. You can't eat too much rainbow on your plate. Yet Americans can brown and beige and white themselves out all day long with a brown cup of coffee and a brown piece of toast and a brown waffle and a brown pancake and a brown sweet roll and go to lunch and have a brown burger on a brown roll with brown french fries and a brown soda pop. And eat brown pretzels in the afternoon with a brown glass of iced tea and go to dinner and have a brown steak with a brown potato and a brown roll and a brown piece of pie. Silly as it sounds, you can go all day long without having color unless you're eating a bag of M&Ms or Skittles. And yet it's those colors that bring the dynamic healing power of food to your body. No, we're not going to get along without fast food restaurants. Fast food restaurants are going to be there, and as our demand goes up for healthier things, we are going to see the emergence of places like the Native Food Cafe and the Veggie Grill and the Life Kitchen expand around the nation. We're going to continue to see the vegan growth of food choices happen in restaurants, just as we've seen the growth of gluten-free products happen in restaurants. We're going to see more vegetarian choices even in the chains. So even though the numbers are kind of tricky to pin down for healthful options because the fast food industry doesn't even have a category for healthful, you know, the industry just has quick serve, fast casual, and limited service restaurants, premium fast casual. It doesn't have a healthful section at all that it even begins to look at. But you can be smart. You can go to your computer. You can type in the restaurant name and go to their nutrition and look it up. I remember the very first time I did it. I've told this story on the air. Bear with me. I had a 12-year-old come to me, and he was having to be picked up by his mom every day because he had cramps, terrible cramps, abdominal cramps, about 10 or 11 o'clock in the morning. And he had to get picked up day after day because he had these terrible cramps, had what was diagnosed by the gastroenterologist as IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. I think IBS stands for I be stupid because it means you haven't been able to figure it out. And so they brought the kid to me because if he missed any more school, he wasn't going to graduate to the next grade. And this was a huge threat to this child. And when he came in to me, I found out very quickly that his mom took him every morning to one of the local fast food restaurants to get an egg and sausage burrito. That was his breakfast. Well, you know, some parts of this aren't really Einstein material. If you eat the same thing for breakfast every morning at 7:30 and you end up with fold-over colic stomach cramps at 10 o'clock, wouldn't you think that it might have something to do with what you ate for breakfast? But they'd never put that together. So, sausage and egg burrito. Okay, sounds a little fatty. Sounds a little questionable because, you know, one of the things that you never want to see happen is the making of sausages. But I went to the website for this particular chain restaurant and looked up a sausage and egg burrito and was quite astounded to find out, and here you get a chance to guess, wait for it, how many ingredients are in a sausage and egg burrito? Ta-da! 79 ingredients in a sausage and egg burrito. Now, I would have guessed a dozen. I might have even stretched it and said 15 or 18, but I never would have guessed 79. And so as I went through the ingredient listing for the wrap, the flour wrap that the burrito was in, and I went through the ingredient listing for the sausage, and then I got to the part about, well, it's called sausage and egg burrito, but it doesn't contain any egg. It contained egg product. Oh, egg product. Sure, I remember Grandma in the backyard going out to the chicken coop and collecting the egg product. Yeah, sounds silly, doesn't it? Well, all we had to do is get this kid to quit eating these sausage and egg burritos, and he didn't have colic anymore, and he didn't need another appointment with a gastroenterologist. Can you imagine how traumatic that was for a 12-year-old? So the next time you're going to have a sausage and egg burrito, why don't you go to the website and look it up and find out whether you want something with 89 ingredients, none of which happen to be egg. So, yeah, be afraid. Be very afraid. Or be smart. Be very smart. And I know you're smart because you listen to community radio. And so what community radio is about is drawing your attention to things. Yes, we're here to entertain you and we're here to educate you, but awareness is always the first step in making a change. And I want you to be a listener for a really long time. So I want you to feel good. And feeling good means you need to give your cells what they evolved on, which is food that occurs in nature. So when you begin to look at where fast food restaurants fit in your life, maybe they'll fit in a little less frequently. That's my suggestion. Because remember, if you fail to plan, you plan to fail.